Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story by F. Scott Fitzgerald, first published in the September 20, 2017 edition of the New Yorker magazine. The story was written in 1920, 5 years before the publication of The Great Gatsby, when Fitzgerald was only 23 years old. The manuscript was originally commissioned by Harper's Bazaar, but it wound up back with the author after he requested time to make revisions, and he never sent it back for publication. And now, The IOU by F. Scott Fitzgerald. The above is not my real name. The fellow it belongs to gave me his permission to sign it to this story. My real name I shall not divulge. I am a publisher. I accept long novels about young love written by old maids in South Dakota, detective stories concerning wealthy clubmen and female Apaches with wide, dark eyes, essays about the menace of this and that and the color of the moon in Tahiti by college professors and other unemployed. I accept no novels by authors under 15 years old. All the columnists and communists, I can never get these two words straight, abuse me because they say I want money. I do. I want it terribly. My wife needs it. My children use it all the time. If someone offered me all the money in New York, I should not refuse it. I would rather bring out a book that had had an advance sale of 500,000 copies than have discovered Samuel Butler, Theodore Dreiser, and James Branch Cabell in 1 year. So would you, if you were a publisher. 6 months ago, I contracted for a book that was undoubtedly a sure thing. It was by Hardin, the psychic research man, Dr. Hardin. His first book, I published it in 1913, had taken hold like a Long Island sand crab, and at that time, psychic research had nowhere near the vogue it has at present. We advertise his new one as being a 50-heart power document. His nephew had been killed in the war, and Dr. Hardin had written with distinction and reticence an account of his psychic communion through various mediums with this nephew, Cosgrove Hardin. Dr. Hardin was no intellectual upstart. He was a distinguished psychologist, Ph.D., Vienna, LL.D., Oxford, and late visiting professor at the University of Ohio. His book was neither callous nor credulous. There was a fundamental seriousness underlying his attitude. For example, he had mentioned in his book that a young man named Wilkins had come to his door claiming that the deceased had owed him $3.80. He had asked Dr. Hardin to find out what the deceased wanted done about it. This Dr. Hardin had steadfastly refused to do. He considered that such a request was comparable to praying to the saints about a lost umbrella. For 90 days, we prepared for publication. The first page of the book was set up in three alternative kinds of type, and two drawings each were ordered from five sky-priced artists before the jacket par excellence was selected. The final proof was read by no less than seven expert proofreaders, lest the slightest tremble in the tail of a comma or the faintest cast in a capital I offend the fastidious eyes of the great American public. 4 weeks before the day set for publication, huge crates went out to 1,000 points of the literate compass. To Chicago alone went 27,000 copies. To Galveston, Texas went 7,000. 100 copies apiece were hurled with sighs into Bisbee, Arizona, Red Wing, Minnesota, and Atlanta, Georgia. The larger cities having been accounted for, stray lots of 20 and 30 and 40 were dropped here and there across the continent as a sand artist fills in his nearly completed picture by fine driftings from his hand. The actual number of books in the first printing was 300,000. Meanwhile, The advertising department was busy from 9 to 5, 6 days of the week, italicizing, underlining, capitalizing, double capitalizing, preparing slogans, headlines, personal articles, and interviews, selecting photographs showing Dr. Hardin thinking, musing, and contemplating, choosing snapshots of him with a tennis racket, with a golf stick, with a sister-in-law, with an ocean. Literary notes were prepared by the gross. Gift copies were piled in stacks, addressed to the critics of 1,000 newspapers and weeklies. The date set was April 15th. On the 14th, a breathless hush pervaded the offices, and below in the retail department, the clerks were glancing nervously at the vacant spaces where the stacks were to rest and at the empty front windows where three expert window dressers were to work all evening arranging the book in squares and mounds and heaps and circles and hearts and stars and parallelograms. On the morning of April 15th at 9:05, Miss Jordan, the head stenographer, fainted from excitement into the arms of my junior partner. On the stroke of 9, an old gentleman with Dundreary whiskers purchased the first copy of The Aristocracy of the Spirit World. The great book was out. It was 3 weeks after this that I decided to run out to Joliet, Ohio, to see Dr. Hardin. This was a case of Mohammed, or was it Moses, and the mountain. He was of a shy and retiring disposition. It was necessary to encourage him, to congratulate him, to forestall the possible advances of rival publishers. I intended to make the necessary arrangements for securing his next book, and with this in mind, I took along several neatly worded contracts that would take all disagreeable business problems off his shoulders for the next 5 years. We left New York at 4:00. It is my custom when on a trip to put half a dozen copies of my principal book in my bag and lend them casually to the most intelligent-looking of my fellow passengers in the hope that the book may thereby be brought to the attention of some new group of readers. Before we came to Trenton, a lady with a lorgnette in one of the staterooms was suspiciously turning the pages of hers. The young man who had the upper of my section was deeply engrossed in his, and a girl with reddish hair and peculiarly mellow eyes was playing tic-tac-toe in the back of a third. For myself, I drowsed. The New Jersey scenery changed unostentatiously to Pennsylvania's scenery. We passed many cows and a great number of woods and fields, and every 20 minutes or so the same farmer would appear, sitting in his wagon beside the village station, chewing tobacco and gazing thoughtfully at the Pullman windows. We must have passed this farmer 10 or 15 times when my nap was suddenly terminated by the realization that the young man who shared my section was moving his foot up and down like a bass drummer in an orchestra and uttering little cries and grunts. I was both startled and pleased, for I could see that he was much moved by the book he clutched tightly in his long white fingers, Dr. Hardin's Aristocracy of the Spirit World. "Well," I remarked jovially, "you seem interested." He looked up. In his thin face were the eyes that are seen in only two sorts of men, those who are up on spiritualism and those who are down on spiritualism. As he seemed still rather dazed, I repeated my inquiry. "Interested," he cried. "Interested, my God!" I looked at him carefully. Yes, he was plainly either a medium or else one of the sarcastic young men who write humorous stories about spiritualists for the popular magazines. "A remarkable piece of work," he said. "The hero, so to speak, has evidently spent most of his time since his death dictating it to his uncle." I agreed that he must have. "Its value, of course," he remarked with a sigh, "depends entirely on the young man being where he says he is." "Of course." I was puzzled. "The young man must be in paradise and not in purgatory." "Yes," he thoughtfully agreed. "It would be embarrassing if he were in purgatory, and more so if he were in the third place." This was rather too much. There was nothing in the young man's life which presupposed that he might be in be in? Well, of course not. The region you refer to was not in my thoughts. I merely said it would be embarrassing if he were in purgatory, but even more embarrassing were he somewhere else.
Well, where, sir?
In Yonkers, for instance.
At this I started.
What? In fact, if he were in purgatory, it would only be a slight error of his own. But if he were in Yonkers...
My dear sir, I broke out impatiently, what possible connection is there between Yonkers and the aristocracy of the spirit world?
None. I merely mentioned that if he were in Yonkers...
But he's not in Yonkers.
No, he's not.
He paused and sighed again.
In fact, he has lately crossed from Pennsylvania into Ohio.
This time I jumped, from sheer nervousness. I had not yet realized at what he was driving, but I felt that his remarks hinted at some significance.
You mean, I demanded quickly, that you feel his astral presence?
The young man drew himself up fiercely.
There's been enough of that, he said intensely. It seems for the last month I have been the sport of the credulous queens and basal kings of the entire United States. My name, sir, happens to be Cosgrove P. Hardin. I am not dead. I have never been dead, and after reading that book, I will never again feel it quite safe to die.
The girl across the aisle was so startled at my cry of grief and astonishment that she put down a tick instead of a tack. I had an immediate vision of a long line of people stretching from 40th Street, where my publishing house stands, down to the Bowery. 500,000 people, each one hugging a copy of The Aristocracy of the Spirit World, each one demanding the return of his or her $2.50. I considered quickly whether I could change all the names and shift the book from my nonfiction to my fiction. But it was too late even for this. 300,000 copies were in the hands of the American public. When I was sufficiently recovered, the young man gave me a history of his experiences since he had been reported dead. 3 months in a German prison, 10 months in a hospital with brain fever, another month before he could remember his own name. Half an hour after his arrival in New York, he had met an old friend who had stared at him, choked, and then fainted dead away. When he revived, they went together to a drugstore to get a cocktail, and in an hour, Cosgrove Hardin had heard the most astonishing story about himself that a man ever listened to. He took a taxi to a bookstore. The book he sought was sold out. Immediately he had started on the train for Joliet, Ohio, and by a rare stroke of fortune, the book had been put in his hands. My first thought was that he was a blackmailer. But by comparing him with his photograph on page 226 of The Aristocracy of the Spirit World, I saw that he was indubitably Cosgrove P. Hardin. He was thinner and older than in the picture. The mustache was gone, but it was the same man. I sighed, profoundly and tragically.
Just when it's selling better than a book of fiction.
Fiction, he responded angrily. It is fiction.
In a sense, I admitted.
In a sense, it is fiction. It fulfills all the requirements of fiction. It is one long, sweet lie.
Would you call it fact?
No, I replied calmly. I should call it nonfiction. Nonfiction is a form of literature that lies halfway between fiction and fact.
He opened the book at random and uttered a short, poignant cry of distress that made the red-haired girl pause in what must have been at least the semifinals of her tic-tac-toe tournament.
Look, he wailed miserably. Look! It says Monday. Consider my existence on this further shore on Monday. I ask you, look, I smell flowers. I spend the day smelling flowers. You see, don't you? On page 194 on the top of the page, I smell a rose.
I lifted the book carefully to my nostrils.
I didn't notice anything, I said. Possibly the ink? don't smell, he cried. Read. I smell a rose, and it gives me two paragraphs of rapture about the instinctive nobility of man. One little smell. Then I devote another hour to daisies. God, I'll never be able to attend another college reunion. He turned a few pages and then groaned again. Here I am with the children, dancing with them. I spend all day with them, and we dance. We don't even do a decent shimmy. We do some aesthetic business. I can't dance. I hate children, but no sooner do I die than I become a cross between a nurse girl and a chorus man. Here now, I ventured reproachfully, that has been considered a very beautiful passage. See, it describes your clothes. You are dressed in, well, let's see, well, a sort of filmy garment. It streams out behind you. A sort of floating undergarment, he said morosely, and I've got leaves all over my head. I had to admit it, leaves were implied. Still, I suggested, think how much worse it could have been. He could have made you really ridiculous if he'd had you answering questions about the number on your grandfather's watch or the $3.80 you owed as a poker debt. There was a pause. Funny egg, my uncle, he said thoughtfully. I think he's a little mad. Not at all, I assured him. I have dealt with authors all my life, and he's quite the sanest one with whom we've ever dealt. He never tried to borrow money from us. He never asked us to fire our advertising department, and he's never assured us that all his friends were unable to get copies of his book in Boston, Massachusetts. Nevertheless, I'm going to take his astral body for an awful beating. Is that all you're going to do? I demanded anxiously. You're not going to appear under your true name and spoil the sale of this book, are you? What? Surely you wouldn't do that. Think of the disappointment you'd cause. You'd make 500,000 people miserable. All women, he said morosely. They like to be miserable. Think of my girl, the girl I was engaged to. How do you think she felt about my flowery course since I left her? Do you think she's been approving my dancing around with a lot of children all over page 221, undraped? I was in despair. I must know the worst at once. What? What are you going to do? Do? He exclaimed wildly. Why, I'm going to have my uncle sent to the penitentiary, along with his publisher and his press agent and the whole crew, down to the merest printer's devil who carried the blasted type. When we reached Joliet, Ohio, at 9 o'clock the next morning, I had calmed him into a semblance of reason. His uncle was an old man, I told him, a misled man. He had been fooled himself. There was little doubt of it. His heart might be weak, and the sight of his nephew coming suddenly up the path might finish him off. It was, of course, in the back of my mind that we could make some sort of a compromise. If Cosgrove could be persuaded to keep out of the way for 5 years or so, for a reasonable sum, all might still be well. So, when we left the little station, we avoided the village and in a depressing silence traversed the half mile to Dr. Harden's house. When we were within 100 yards, I stopped and turned to him. You wait here, I urged him. I've got to prepare him for the shock. I'll be back in half an hour. He demurred at first, but finally sat down sullenly in the thick grass by the roadside. Drying my damp brow, I walked up to the lane to the house. The garden of Dr. Harden was full of sunshine and blossomed with Japanese magnolia trees dropping pink tears over the grass. I saw him immediately, sitting by an open window. The sun was pouring in, creeping in stealthily, lengthening squares across his desk and the litter of papers that strewed it. Then over the lap of Dr. Harden himself and up to his shaggy, white-topped face. Before him on his desk was an empty brown envelope, and his lean fingers were moving busily over the sheaf of newspaper clippings he had just extracted. I had come quite close, half hidden by the magnolias, and was about to address him when I saw a girl in a purple morning dress stooping through the low branch cluster of apple trees that made the north end of the garden and move across the grass toward the house. I drew back and watched her as she came directly up to the window, and she spoke unabashed to the great Dr. Harden.
"I want to have a talk with you," she said abruptly.
Dr. Harden looked up, and a section of the Philadelphia Press fluttered from his hand. I wondered if it was the clipping that called him the new St. John.
"About this stuff," the girl continued.
She drew a book from under her arm. It was The Aristocracy of the Spirit World. I recognized it by the red cover with the angels in the corners.
"About this stuff,"
she repeated angrily, and then shied the book violently into a bush, where it skimmed down between two wild roses and perched disconsolately among the roots.
"Why, Miss Thalia!"
"Why, Miss Thalia!" she mimicked. "Why, you old fool! You ought to be crocked off for writing this book!"
"Crocked off?" Dr. Harden's voice expressed a faint hope that this might be some new honor. He was not left long in doubt.
"Crock off," she blazed forth. "You heard me. My gosh, can't you understand English? Haven't you ever been to a prom?"
"I was unaware," Dr. Harden replied coolly, "that college proms were held in the Bowery, and I know no precedent for using an abbreviation of the noun crockery as a transitive verb. As for the book..."
"It's the world's worst disgrace."
"Well, if you will read these clippings..." She put her elbows on the windowsill, moved as though she intended to hoist herself through, and then suddenly dropped her chin in her hands, and looking at him, level-eyed, began to talk.
"You had a nephew," she said. "That was his hard luck. He was the best man that ever lived, and the only man I ever loved or ever will love."
Dr. Harden nodded and made as though to speak, but Thalia knocked her little fist on the windowsill and continued.
"He was brave and square and quiet. He died of wounds in a foreign town and passed out of sight as Sergeant Harden, 105th Infantry. A quiet life and an honorable death. What have you done?"
Her voice rose slightly until it shook and sent a sympathetic vibration over the window vines.
"What have you done? You've made him a laughingstock. You've called him back to life as a fabulous creature who sends idiotic messages about flowers and birds and the number of fillings in George Washington's teeth. You've..."
Dr. Harden rose to his feet. "Have you come here," he began shrilly, "to tell me what..."
"Shut up!" she cried. "I'm going to tell you what you've done, and you can't stop me with all the astral bodies this side of the Rocky Mountains."
Dr. Harden subsided into his chair. "Go on," he said with an effort at self-control. "Talk your shrewish head off." She paused for a moment, and turning her head, looked into the garden. I could see that she was biting her lip and blinking to keep back the tears. Then she fixed her dark eyes on him again.
"You've taken him," she continued, "and used him as a piece of dough for your crooked medium to make pie out of. Pie for all the hysterical women who think you're a great man. Call you great? Without any respect for the dignity and reticence of death? You're a toothless, yellow old man without even the excuse of real grief for playing on your own credulity and that of a lot of other fools. That's all. I'm through."
With that, she turned and, as suddenly as she had come, walked with her head erect down the path toward me. I waited until she had passed and gone some 20 yards out of the sight of the window. Then I followed her along the soft grass and spoke to her. "Miss Thalia?" She faced me, somewhat startled. "Miss Thalia, I want to tell you that there's a surprise for you down the lane. Somebody you haven't seen for many months." Her face showed no understanding. I don't want to spoil anything, I continued, but I don't want you to be frightened if in a few moments you get the surprise of your existence. What do you mean? She asked quietly. Nothing, I said. Just continue along the road and think of the nicest things in the world, and all of a sudden something tremendous will happen. With this, I bowed very low and stood smiling benevolently with my hat in my hand. I saw her look at me wonderingly and then turn slowly and walk away. In a moment, she was lost to view beyond the curve of the low stone wall under the magnolia trees. It was 4 days, 4 sweltering, anxious days, before I could bring enough order out of the chaos to arrange any sort of business conference. The first meeting between Cosgrove Hardin and his uncle was the most tremendous nervous strain of my life. I sat for an hour on the slippery edge of a rickety chair, preparing to spring forward every time I saw young Cosgrove's muscles tighten under his coat sleeve. I would make an instinctive start, and each time slip helplessly from the chair and land in a sitting position on the floor. Dr. Hardin finally terminated the interview by rising and going upstairs. I managed to pack young Hardin off to his room by dint of threats and promises and wrung out of him a vow of 24 hours of silence. I used all my available cash in bribing the two old servants. They must say nothing, I assured them. Mr. Cosgrove Hardin had just escaped from Sing Sing. I quaked as I said this, but there were so many lies in the air that one more or less made little difference. If it hadn't been for Miss Thalia, I would have given up the first day and gone back to New York to wait the crash. But she was in such a state of utter and beatific happiness that she was willing to agree to anything. I proposed to her that if she and Cosgrove were to marry and live in the West under an assumed name for 10 years, I would support them liberally. She jumped for joy. I seized the opportunity and with glowing colors painted a love bungalow in California, with mild weather all the year around, and Cosgrove coming up the path to supper, and romantic old missions nearby, and Cosgrove coming up the path to supper, and Golden Gate in a June twilight, and Cosgrove, and so forth. As I talked, she gave little cries of joy and was all for leaving immediately. It was she who persuaded Cosgrove on the 4th day to join us in the conference in the living room. I left word with the maid that we were on no account to be disturbed, and we sat down to thresh the whole thing out. Our points of view were radically divergent. Young Hardin's was very similar to the Red Queen's. Someone had blundered, and someone had to suffer for it right away. There had been enough fake dead men in this family, and there was going to be a real one if someone didn't look out. Dr. Hardin's point of view was that it was all an awful mess, and he didn't know what to do about it. God knew, and he wished he were dead. Thalia's point of view was that she had looked up California in a guidebook, and the climate was adorable, and Cosgrove coming up the path to supper. My point of view was that there was no knot so tight that there wasn't a way out of the labyrinth, and a lot more mixed metaphors that only got everybody more confused than they had been in the beginning. Cosgrove Hardin insisted that we get 4 copies of The Aristocracy of the Spirit World and talk it over. His uncle said that the sight of a book would make him sick to his stomach. Thalia's suggestion was that we should all go to California and settle the question out there. I got 4 books and distributed them. Dr. Hardin shut his eyes and groaned. Thalia opened hers to the last page and began drawing heavenly bungalows with a young wife standing in the doorway of each. Young Hardin hunted furiously for page 226. Here we are, he cried, just opposite the picture of Cosgrove Hardin the day before he sailed. Showing the small mole above his left eye, we see the following. This mole had always worried Cosgrove. He had a feeling that bodies should be perfect, and that this was an imperfection that should be in the natural order washed away.
I have no mole, Dr. Harden agreed.
Possibly it was an imperfection in the negative, he suggested.
Great Scott, if the negative had failed to photograph my left leg, you'd probably have me yearning all through the book for a left leg and have it joined to me in chapter 29.
Look here, I broke in. Can't we reach some compromise? No one knows that you are in town. Can't we?
Young Harden scowled at me fiercely.
I haven't started yet. I haven't mentioned the alienation of Thalia's affection.
Alienation? Dr. Harden protested. Why, I have paid her no attention. She detests me. She...
Cosgrove laughed bitterly.
You flatter yourself. Do you think I was jealous of your old gray whiskers? I'm talking about her affections being alienated by these descriptions of me.
Thalia bent forward earnestly.
My affections never wavered, Cosgrove, never.
Calm, Thalia, Cosgrove said somewhat grumpily. They must have been slightly alienated.
How about page 223? Could you love a man who wore floating underwear? Who was filmy?
I was grieved, Cosgrove. That is, I would have been grieved if I'd believed it. But I didn't.
No alienation? His tone expressed disappointment.
None, Cosgrove.
Well, Cosgrove said resentfully, I'm ruined politically anyway. I mean, if I decided to go into politics, I can never be president. I'm not even a Democratic ghost. I'm a spiritual snob.
Dr. Harden's face was sunk in his hands in an attitude of profound dejection.
I interrupted desperately, talking so loudly that Cosgrove was compelled to stop and listen. I will guarantee you $10,000 a year if you will go away for 10 years.
Thalia clapped her hands, and Cosgrove, seeing her out of the corner of his eye, began for the first time to show a faint interest.
Well, how about after the 10 years are up?
Oh, I said hopefully, Dr. Harden, maybe...
Speak up, said the doctor gloomily. I may be dead. I sincerely trust so.
So you can come back under your own name, I continued callously. Meanwhile, we'll agree to publish no new edition of the book.
Suppose he's not dead in 10 years, Cosgrove demanded suspiciously.
Oh, I'll die, the doctor assured him quickly. That needn't worry you.
How do you know you'll die? How does one know anyone will die? It's just human nature.
Cosgrove regarded him sourly. Humor is out of place in this discussion. If you'll make an honest agreement to die with no mental reservations...
The doctor nodded gloomily. I might as well. With the money I have left, I'll starve to death in that time.
Well, that would be satisfactory. And when you do, for heaven's sake, arrange to have yourself buried. Don't just lie around the house here dead and expect me to come back and do all the work.
At this, the doctor seemed somewhat bitter, and then Thalia, who had been silent for some time, raised her head.
Do you hear anything outside? She asked curiously.
I had heard something. That is, I had subconsciously perceived a murmur growing and mingling with the sound of many footsteps.
I do, I remarked. Odd.
There was a sudden interruption. The murmur outside swelled to the proportions of a chant. The door burst open, and a wild-eyed servant rushed in.
Dr. Harden! Dr. Harden! She cried in terror. There's a mob, maybe a million people, coming along the road and up toward the house. They'll be on the porch in a...
An increase in the noise showed that they had already were. I sprang to my feet.
Hide your nephew, I shouted to Dr. Harden.
His beard trembling, his watery eyes wide, Dr. Harden grasped Cosgrove feebly by the elbow.
What is it?
He faltered.
I don't know. Get him upstairs to the attic right away. Put leaves over him. Stick him behind an heirloom.
With that, I was gone, leaving the three of them in puzzled panic. Through the hall I rushed, and out the front door onto the screen porch. I was none too soon. The screen porch was full of men. Young men in checked suits and slouch hats, old men in derbies and frayed cuffs, crowding and jostling, each one beckoning and calling to me above the crowd. Their one distinguishing mark was a pencil in the right hand and a notebook in the left. A notebook open, waiting, virginally yet ominously pretentious. Behind them on the lawn was a larger crowd, butchers and bakers in their aprons, fat women with folded arms, thin women holding up dirty children so that they might better see, shouting boys, barking dogs, horrible little girls who jumped up and down shouting and clapping their hands. Behind these, in a sort of outer ring, stood the old men of the village, toothless, musty-eyed, their mouths open, their gray beards tickling the tops of their canes. Over behind them, the setting sun, blood-red and horrible, played on 300 twisting shoulders. After the burst of noise that succeeded my appearance, a silence fell, a deep hush, pregnant with significance. And out of this hush came a dozen voices from the men with notebooks in front of me. Jenkins of the Toledo Blade, Harlan of the Cincinnati News, Magruder of the Dayton Times, Corey of the Zanesville Republican, Jordan of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Carmichael of the Columbus News, Martin of the Lima Herald, Ryan of the Akron World. It was weird, uncanny, like some map of Ohio gone mad, with the miles refusing to square and the towns jumping about from county to county. My brain quivered. Then again the hush fell. I noticed a commotion in the middle of the crowd, a sort of wave or eddy floating down the center like a thin line of wind blowing through a wheat field. "What do you want?" I cried hollowly. Like one voice came the response from half a thousand throats. "Where is Cosgrove Harden?" It was out. The reporters swarmed about me, pleading, threatening, demanding. "Kept it pretty close, didn't you? Almost didn't leak out. Pays to pay bills. Won't he give an interview? Send us the old faker." Then that strange eddy in the field of people suddenly reached the front and died out. A tall young man with yellow hair and stilt-like legs emerged dynamically from the crowd, and dozens of willing hands propelled him forward to me. Up to the porch he came, up the steps. "Who are you?" I shouted. "Name's Albert Wilkins. I'm the fellow that told." He paused and his chest swelled. It was his great moment. He was the immortal messenger of the gods. "I recognized him the day he came. You see, you see," we all swayed forward eagerly. "I got his IOU for $3.80 he lost to me at draw poker. And I want my money." I am a publisher. I publish any sort of book. I am looking for a book that will sell 500,000 copies. This is the season for novels with a psychic turn. If possible, I would prefer something by a fervent materialist about a wealthy clubman and a dark Apaches, or something about love. Love is a sure thing. It takes a living man to love. Next, from the September 21st, 2021 online edition of the New Yorker magazine, the Elements section, "Where Do Species Come From?" By studying crows, a German biologist has helped to solve a centuries-old mystery. By Ben Crayer. The evolutionary biologist Jochen Wolf was working from home when we first spoke in April 2020. Germany was under lockdown, and his lab at Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich had been closed for weeks. Still, a reminder of his research had followed him from the office. "I have a crow nest right in front of me," Wolf said from his rooftop terrace. The nest was well hidden at the top of a tall spruce tree. Through the branches, Wolf could see a female crow sitting on her eggs. Over the years, Wolf had climbed many similar trees to gather genetic material from crows. He had also collected samples from falconers, whose goshawks hunt the birds. By comparing the genomes of European crows, Wolf wanted to bring fresh data to one of biology's oldest and most intractable debates. Scientists have named more than a million different species, but they still argue over how any given species evolves into another, and do not even agree on what exactly a species is. 3 years before he would publish On Origin of Species in 1859, Charles Darwin wrote to a friend, "I have just been comparing definitions of species. It is really laughable to see what different ideas are prominent in various naturalist minds." To an extent, the same holds true today. It is difficult to find a definition of species that works for organisms as different as goshawks and spruce trees. Similarly, it can be hard to draw a line between organisms among whom there are only small differences, such as the goshawks in North America, Europe, and Siberia. Are they separate species, subspecies, or simply locally adapted populations of a single type? Darwin thought that the blurriness of species boundaries was a clue that the living world was not a divine creation, but actually changing over time. He encouraged biologists to treat species as, quote, merely artificial combinations made for convenience, end quote, which would never map perfectly onto nature. He wrote, "We shall at least be freed from the vain search for the undiscovered and undiscoverable essence of the term species." His impression, however, did not sit well with all of his successors. One of the most influential evolutionary biologists of the 20th century, a German-born ornithologist named Ernst Mayr, attacked Darwin for failing, quote, to solve the problem indicated by the title of his work, end quote. Darwin had shown how natural selection honed a species to its niche, but he'd, quote, never seriously attempted a rigorous analysis of the problem of the multiplication of species, of the splitting of one species into two, Mayr wrote in 1963. Mayr, who spent much of his career at Harvard, called speciation, quote, the most important single event in evolution, end quote, and proposed reproductive isolation as an, quote, objective yardstick, end quote, for understanding it. Individuals of a sexually reproducing species could procreate with one another, but not with individuals of other species. For decades, Mayr's arguments dominated evolutionary thought. But consensus was crumbling by the 2000s when Wolf confronted the species. As Wolf and I spoke, a pair of crows landed on my balcony in Berlin. Since the beginning of the pandemic, I had been feeding them hard-boiled eggs and peanuts. That morning, I'd set out a jar of water thinking that they might enjoy a drink as well. The birds were a good example of the species problem. In Munich, Wolf was watching all black carrion crows. In Berlin, I was watching hooded crows with gray breasts and bodies. During the most recent ice age, glaciers in the Alps and Scandinavia divided an ancestral population of crows into two. At that time, all the crows were probably black. The eastern population found refuge in the Balkans or the Middle East and turned gray for some reason. Perhaps lighter feathers helped them stay cool, whereas the western population retreated into Spain. 12,000 years ago, when the glaciers melted, the two populations reconvened in Central Europe. Carrion and hooded crows sometimes interbred and produce fertile and healthy offspring in a narrow hybrid zone running through cities such as Dresden and Vienna. But the birds retained distinct identities on both sides of this feather curtain. Wolf said, "It's black and gray crows with a hybrid zone exactly through the center of Germany." Mayr himself had wondered why the two groups did not recombine into a single population. Others saw them as a case that contradicted Mayr's ideas. Wolf believed that, using powerful new genome sequencing technology, he could find an answer to the mystery of the crow species. But its first results, published in the journal Science in 2014, suggested that any concept of species was inadequate for capturing the reality of the crow's evolution, and by extension, the complexity of the natural world. In a commentary that appeared alongside Wolf's study, the Dutch geneticist Peter de Knyft wrote, "No matter how hard we try, there cannot be a robust, all-inclusive, objective species concept. Instead, an emerging field, speciation genomics, was leaving the species concept behind." A few weeks after my phone call with Wolf, Germany eased its travel restrictions, and I took a train from Berlin to Munich to visit him. "I think it's an age thing," Wolf said, when I told him how much I had come to enjoy my observations of the crows. Tall and fit, with shoulder-length hair and a strong jaw, Wolf had started studying local birds in his 30s. Born outside of Munich in 1976, he spent his boyhood in the Bavarian forests that skirt the Alps, and he was drawn to biology as a way to keep on playing in the woods. Later, he studied the behavior of wolves in Poland, black bears in Maine, and sea lions in the Galapagos Islands. In the Galapagos, it was natural to grow interested in Darwin and evolution. You start asking, why does this pup survive and get fat and healthy and the other one doesn't? Wolf said. As a PhD student in the early 2000s, he wanted to find out whether sea lions associated mainly with their family members or also made friends with non-relatives. Wolf snuck up on beached sea lions and wrestled them to the ground while a colleague nicked a sample from their flippers. He would later determine the sea lion's blood relations using a method patented by a German geneticist named Dietard Tautz. The method was similar to the paternity test used by American talk show hosts in popular You Are Not the Father segment. Nature published Sleven and Tautz's study in 1994. The next year, in a paper in Trends in Ecology and Evolution, an English biologist named James Mallet attacked the biological species concept itself, finding it neither useful in practice nor in evolutionary theory. In his own research, Mallet was identifying frequent hybridization between commonly recognized species of tropical butterflies. Other scientists were discovering natural hybridization between wolves and coyotes, blue whales and fin whales, and human beings and Neanderthals. Reproductive isolation was obviously a point of no return in the speciation's process for sexual organisms. A goshawk and a spruce tree could not procreate, but it no longer seemed as absolute or as inviolable as Meyer had proposed. Processes lead to speciation are continuous rather than. The taxonomy of European crows had been a problem for centuries. Carl Linnaeus, the Swedish botanist who invented the modern system of taxonomy, first classified carrion and hooded crows as separate species in 1758. Since then, many taxonomists have argued that they should be considered subspecies instead. On the one hand, the crows were visually and geographically distinct. On the other, they were ecologically identical and produced fertile offspring. Even inside the hybrid zone, however, hooded and carrion crows tended to mate with their own kind. Only occasionally would they form a hybrid pair. Hybrid crows blended the appearances of their parents, grayer than carrion crows, darker than hooded ones. The pattern on their breasts sometimes looked like herringbone. For Wolf, the interesting question was not whether you called the crows species or subspecies, but how they maintained their distinct appearances and ranges despite the flow of genes through the hybrid zone. In 2008, Wolf won a grant to study the crow problem. At Uppsala University in Sweden, where Linnaeus had once taught biology, Wolf worked with a Dutch PhD student named Jelmer Poelstra. The two looked for genetic differences between the crows. Technology limited them to sequencing just a few hundred base pairs at a time. A year went by. "We found nothing at all," Poelstra said. But Wolf had also started to tinker with a new technology called high-throughput sequencing. The first human genome had taken 13 years and billions of dollars to sequence. Now, advances in computing power and chemistry were making it possible to sequence a full genome for a few thousand dollars in a matter of days. The advance was so massive, it just changed the scope of what you could dream about doing. Patrick Nosel, an evolutionary biologist who studies speciation in stick insects, said. Wolf became one of the first evolutionary biologists to deploy high-throughput sequencing in the field. He obtained the full genomes of 60 individual crows in an attempt to identify every last genetic difference between the hooded and carrion populations. Wolf and Palestra, along with a growing team of students, spent years at their computers, poring over terabytes of data and aligning the genomes for each crow. When they first saw the results, in 2012, Wolf wondered if they had made an error. The genomes of hooded and carrion crows mapped almost perfectly onto one another. "They're identical," Wolf said. There were, of course, variations among the crows, but only 0.28% of the crows' genomes could be used to sort the individuals into carrion and hooded populations. In fact, German carrion crows shared more of their DNA with German hooded crows than they did with other carrion crows from Spain. There were only 82 base pairs that never matched, less than 0.1% of the total genome, a fraction so tiny that it should be statistically irrelevant. By comparison, human beings have millions of fixed genetic differences with chimpanzees, their closest living relatives. Even the taxonomist who wanted to lump the crows together as a single species would have predicted magnitudes more. Biologists, unsatisfied with Darwin's view of species as merely artificial combinations made for convenience, had longed for a definitive way to pinpoint when a species had been made. But genome sequencing showed that Darwin had been closer to the truth. When you decide to call them species should depend on why you want to call them species, Chung E. Wu, a biologist from the University of Chicago, told me. Wu compared the process to human development. There is no fixed point at which a child becomes an adult. That determination depends on a variety of biological, cultural, and legal consideration. Similarly, ecologists, conservation biologists, and other scientists are free to choose where in the speciation process it makes the most sense to start thinking about their populations as species. They could also decide to set the term aside altogether. The academic debate about speciation doesn't need species concepts, Wolf said. It's not worth fighting about them. When the crow study by Wolf's team was published in Science in 2014, it was one of the first papers to show how high-throughput sequencing could transform our understandings of species and speciation. Their study was the first convincing demonstration that you could have this one block of the genome that really Jerry Coyne, an authority on speciation from the University of Chicago, wrote that the crow's evolution was a puzzle that has largely been solved. The Knuff, the Dutch geneticist, called it a roadmap for speciation research. The genomic methods that Wolf deployed have become widespread in biology, including, controversially, in studies of human behavior. Wolf's group went on to find a similar dynamic at a second crow hybrid zone in Siberia, where the crows turned from gray to black again. He is currently leading speciation studies in killer whales, cuckoo birds, and yeast. "The lab is becoming a zoo right now," he said. One question his team could not answer, however, was why crows that are reproductively compatible were sorting themselves out according to color. Some people had asked Wolf if the crows were racist. He didn't want to apply such a loaded human concept to animals. Still, the crows did discriminate in their way. Carrion crows wanted to mate with carrion crows, and hooded crows wanted to mate with hooded crows. How could color variation based on such a tiny genetic difference have such a large effect? Wolf thought the answer lay not in the genome, but rather in the field he had left behind, animal behavior. Conrad Lorenz, a Nobel Prize-winning biologist from Austria, formalized the study of animal behavior, or ethology, in the middle of the 20th century. Lorenz's most famous insight came when he hatched and raised a clutch of goslings. Not only did the young birds treat him as their mother, but when they matured, they sought out human mates. Lorenz realized that the geese had no innate sexual preference. Rather, they learned to recognize appropriate mates by imprinting on their parents in the first days of their lives. Crows and most other birds also imprint. Wolf has come to think that this might be the mechanism of their speciation. If carrion crows imprint on carrion crows and hooded crows imprint on hooded crows, then the occasional hybrid, who looks like neither, will be disadvantaged when it comes to finding mates. This process of social marginalization, Wolf believes, may be enough to create effective reproductive isolation, even though the birds' genomes are perfectly compatible. He now wants to find out just how long this mechanism has been operating. Crow bones are common in ancient human trash piles. Eating crow used to be more than just a figure of speech, and by sequencing the Wolf hopes to determine whether cavemen ate hooded crows in Eastern Europe and carrion crows in Western Europe, reconstructing the bird speciation continuum with data points stretching back thousands of years. This spring, Wolf told me that a pair of carrion crows had once again built a nest in a spruce tree outside his house. My hooded crows were still visiting as well. Within a year of lockdowns, their menu had expanded to include not only peanuts and eggs, but also cashews, cat food, and canned fish. They'd built their nest in a tree nearby, and after they arrived on my balcony, I could run down the stairs and around the corner to watch them as they delivered to their babies the food I'd left outside. Having grown up in North America, where the crows are black, I had always found the gray plumage of Berlin's hooded crows dowdy and strange. Now I knew that I was looking at something as revealing as the beak of a finch or the wings of a peppered moth, a uniform fashioned from just a thimbleful of base pairs. It was the seamless needlework of evolutionary change. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.